relative importance of culture and creed in the formation of Americans. What I want to do is suggest that America and Americans have been and continue to be formed by both culture and creed. And I do this with no purpose of evasion, but simply to make sense of the American experience as best and as fully as I can. And I don't think this can be done without taking both concepts seriously. I want first to talk about what we mean by creed, then what we mean by culture, or a kind of fertile tradition, and in particular I want to suggest two ways in which America has been culturally defined. First, what might we mean by creed? The word creed derives from the Latin for belief, credo, I believe, but it's commonly understood to mean a kind of formal or authoritative statement of doctrine. And for purposes of my remarks, I'm going to take it to mean a kind of philosophic, systematic account of fundamental beliefs or principles that might define America, because they are ideas to which America and Americans have had a recourse to understand and articulate their purposes as a nation. The word creed, I think, strictly speaking, need not point to something quite as systematic or philosophical as that, but I'll take it as that for the sake of argument, and I hope a kind of provocative clarity. So, if we use this sense, we can say that the American experience, especially at the founding moment, but also before then and after then, has in fact been quite creedal. This creedal interpretation, by common assent, I think, of supporters and detractors, is most notably expressed in the early lines of the Declaration of Independence with the assertion that we Americans hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. There, of course, have been disputes over the meaning of American principles, especially this creedal formulation, the most noticeable one centered on the Civil War. Whatever one might think of the rectitude of the various positions on the Civil War, both then and now, it seems to me one can't deny that this creedal interpretation of America was central to the thinking of Lincoln, and in some important ways triumphed, at least temporarily. For Lincoln, as for the founders, we are a people, as are all people, endowed with certain inalienable natural rights. Natural rights, in turn, stem from a fact of nature, our being equal human beings. And by this, I mean politically equal, not the self-evident falsehood that men are equal in all respects. How do we know we are politically equal? We use our reason to observe ourselves and others and come to the rational conclusion that no man is so markedly superior to another, or specifically marked out by God, so as to be entitled to rule without the consent of the ruled. So consent, and therefore the formation of government by social contract, is an inexorable conclusion of an observable fact of nature, independent of all customs, conventions, traditions, and cultures. And indeed, all liberal democratic forms of government, I would suggest, recognize, if not explicitly, then at least implicitly, the fundamental fact of human equality. Not to recognize this is to argue, I think, for another form of government, a non-liberal democratic form of government. Now, all this is from John Locke, and I think it's quite evident, not only in the Declaration of Independence and Jeffersonian thought, but also in the thinking of most other prominent founders representing a wide spectrum of views of the founding era. It's also evident, of course, in sermons, in state declarations of rights, and state constitutions themselves. But this isn't, of course, to deny that particular grievances and Protestant piety move the hearts of Americans during the founding era, but the intellectual coherence for this era is provided, I think, by this creedal social contractarian formulation. One way to express this creedal formulation is that America is a nation of Lockean natural rights, and admittedly this is a very rough way to state that. There are many qualifications would have to be made. There are other ways to express the same notions, but for purposes of today this will be our shorthand, or at least my shorthand. That America, and at least many of the most prominent Americans, have dedicated themselves to a proposition, I think, is undeniable. It's there. It's the 800-pound gorilla in the living room. Not to see it or to downplay it unduly, I think, would be to miss something very important. And we see it even today. George W. Bush's claim that freedom is not America's gift to the world, but God's gift to all mankind, might sound a note of Wilsonian progressivism to some, but as a statement of principle, duly limited by prudent statesmanship as to what is actually attainable, it is quite compatible with the American creed, and in particular a theory of natural rights that shows rights exist in nature, the bequest not of a government or of a particular tradition or culture, but of an omnipotent, just God. I might add that I personally was very aware of the creed of America looking at the country from the outside. I came to the United States very late in the 20th century, 1990 to be precise, and I think, like most foreigners, was very much aware of America as a creedal nation. And in fact, many foreigners love nothing more than to show the alleged American hypocrisy when America does not live up to its universal principles. So again, I think it's there and it's easy for most people to see. And I might add that Lockean natural rights-based social compact theory, despite its importance for America, died in Europe almost before it was born, even in the English-speaking world, due in no small part to the blows leveled against it by David Hume, among others. In America, social compact and natural rights as central ordering concepts of politics and morality lived, albeit they fought for their lives at times, from the founding period through much of the 19th century, succumbing, notwithstanding occasional restatements from characters as diverse as Calvin Coolidge, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush, succumbing only to the dogma of historical progress growing out of social Darwinism, pragmatism, 20th century progressivism, and finally modern liberalism. Their longevity here, I think, is accounted for by their pride of place in the founders' thinking, and of course the founders' pride of place in ours. I won't say more about this now because I'm sure questions will arise. So let me move to culture. What do we mean by culture? This word derives from the Latin colo or cultura, to care for, refine, raise up, especially in an agricultural sense. And it's commonly understood when applied to public questions to have an organic as opposed to a principled, philosophic, or creedal connotation. Cultural conditions are therefore the soil and the fertilizer in which political systems take root and grow, and out of which they define themselves with reference to particulars, as opposed to philosophical universals. This land, as opposed to the cosmos, as it were. So for purposes of this forum, I'll take the word culture to mean that set of traditions, conventions, orientations, institutions, religious and secular, that America has inherited from elsewhere, and eventually, of course, built on itself. Notably, the Western classical and Judeo-Christian traditions, as Ellis and Bruce have so skillfully limbed, but also more particularly the British political and legal tradition. The first thing to note about culture, I think, is, and this is often glossed over, but the first thing to note is that our creed, as I have described it, is in some large measure based or grows out of culture. Natural rights principles that lead to liberal democracy might be universal, but this by no means implies that they can be implemented universally or immediately, or even seen by all. The fact that many nations remain even today outside the family of liberal democratic nations is testament to the enduring importance of cultural, religious, political, and moral traditions that cut against the recognition of natural rights. In the United States, one can say that constitutional democracy was by no means, or republicanism, was by no means inevitable. The American founders thought and acted certainly with great originality and boldness, and they had broad sympathy for the nascent principles of liberty, but had America not been settled largely by Englishmen, or at least those familiar with the English conception of liberty and Scottish Enlightenment and so forth, it would without question have been a very different country. It's highly unlikely that American understandings and institutions would have taken the shape they did had not the founders been profoundly influenced by the constitutional history, political philosophy, and common law doctrines originating in England. The constitutional history of England was understood by the founders as the story of the unfolding of liberal institutions and practices, largely through the gradual limiting of royal power, from Magna Carta to the Petition of Right, through the growth of the common law and independent courts, and perhaps the most significant events surrounded, as has been mentioned, the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 1689, of which Locke gave, in part, a theoretical account. The revolution, among other things, put a stop to royal power to suspend laws, required free and frequent elections for Parliament, and these moves, coupled with the barring of Roman Catholic accession to the British throne, were seen as according with Locke's theory that legitimate sovereign power only exists as a result of social compact between the people in the form of their representatives in Parliament and the monarch. By the mid-1760s, Lockean social compact theory was exercising considerable influence in British North America, as I've mentioned. Preachers, statesmen, political activists in the American colonies argued with explicit reference to Locke that the king and Parliament ruled America without the consent of the governed and concomitantly failed to protect the rights of colonists. Lockean doctrine, in fact, found its most succinct expression in many ways in America. As I say, it disappeared as an ordering concept more quickly in Europe. So we can say the founders, we owe much to the founders, and of course, quite naturally, the founders owe much to their particular the particular intellectual and cultural resources on which they drew. So it's reasonable to say that we imported traditional or historically situated notions which led to our creed. But that makes the creed no less true, no less universal. But there's another sense or meaning of culture that I want to deal with too. That is, tradition not in the sense of intellectual building and borrowing, rather this other sense of tradition, also very appealing, I think, to conservatives, is characterized by a number of different things. Here I'm speaking of, first, traditions that are understood, in many cases, pre-rationally. That is, as things that are given or imbibed rather than argued for. Secondly, traditions that predate philosophical, Lockean, natural rights, liberalism, or anything that led up to it. Thirdly, traditions that are therefore not as uniquely American as, say, creedal statements found in the Declaration and elsewhere. Fourthly, traditions that do not argue, at least unequivocally, for equality and consent as organizing principles of just societies. One way to express this cultural or more organic formulation is to suggest that America is less a Lockean, more a Humean nation. That is, one that can be understood along the customary lines of Hume, the greatest critic of social compact theory, among other things. And there indeed, I think, is something to be said for this view. We can't downplay unduly the importance of this sense of custom, tradition, culture to the founding and to the way we still understand the Constitution and ourselves. The founding certainly betrays a certain form of Enlightenment liberalism as it betrays a genuine conservatism. I would say that the American founders intentionally melded conclusions of reason with institutions and ideas of a traditional or customary caste, institution and ideas whose strength and direction would be provided by a prejudice and prescription. So using our shorthand for today, the founding was a product of Hume as well as Locke. It relied on social compact theory while recognizing this theory's natural limits. It was a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll. According to Hume, men have a moral political sense, but it comes not from reason, but from human sentiment, honed through long experience with things moral, political, religious, legal, things we may call cultural in a certain way. We have memory of things past that help define who we are now and where we might go in the future. According to Hume, universal principles have little place in defining the shape of or attachments formed within actual societies. There are no absolutes in politics. Governments are founded not on contract, but on a slow incremental coalescing of sentiments around certain political forms. For governments to be long maintained, much depends on the cultural or experiential commonalities of people, the things that unite their sentiments, including very particular understandings. So, for example, if consent exists, it is the product, not the precursor of a set of social practices for Hume. And for Hume, all this has a certain common sense quality, I think. People do not actually think of themselves as owing allegiance to a particular regime because of consent, but rather because of birth. In other words, historical happenstance. You owe allegiance to the motherland that raised you, as you owe allegiance to your mother herself, regardless of, and sometimes quite in spite of, rational principles or insights. Hume, by the way, was the first philosopher to write a history of England. This, he believed, was the way to understand a people and their social institutions rather than through philosophy or universals independent of experience. So there is, for Hume, a radically destabilizing, innovative tendency in social compact theory, a kind of unbridled enthusiasm for choice and individualism that's inappropriate to decent politics. In attacking social compact, Hume, therefore, paradoxically blends a kind of radical skepticism of certitudes with a basically conservative love of tradition and spontaneous order. Government institutions must moderate and control destructive passions. The form of a regime, democracy, monarchy, aristocracy, so forth, is not a central concern of Hume's. To claim the social obligations we are born to are ours to undo has for Hume a very dangerous tendency. Habitual ways of thinking and being can't be uprooted without great cost. Our notions of just and unjust, good and evil, must be rooted in patterns of behavior, and the legitimacy of government itself depends on such things. Now, very quickly, what are the evidences of Hume's understanding of culture and tradition and the stability and order that went with it in America? There are many sorts. I'll just name a few in the interest of time, since I see that we're over at the 11 o'clock mark. First of all, the founders never doubted, of course, the centrality of Christian religion and morality to the success of the American experiment. They happened to believe that reason and revelation were true guides to human affairs, and furthermore, they pointed in the same direction on questions of natural rights and moral conduct, but they thought it was traditional religion more than philosophy that could reliably instruct and discipline the many, as Washington, for example, notes in his farewell address. Even the Declaration of Independence itself, secondly, refutes an interpretation that would suggest that it emphasizes unfettered contractual freedom residing in individuals. It does so by noting that prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right them themselves. Thirdly, the founders understood that society naturally articulates itself into myriad interests, opinions, and passions over the course of time, even though we are created equal. These are best controlled by allowing them to compete and cancel each other in a large republic, an idea that Madison in Federalist 10 borrowed from Hume. Private rights and the public good could be promoted, as it were, naturally by the forces of society working upon themselves rather than by recourse to theoretical doctrines. Fourthly, the existence of particular institutions, there are many you could point to, but take the Senate, for example, exist as decisive checks on immediate, unreflective popular sovereignty to prevent radical swings of public mood from affecting public policy. And there are others, but let me say that social compact, I think, can be seen as a principal means of securing what might be called, to borrow a concept from Aquinas, the primary or common precepts of a decent politics. If we take Locke seriously, as the founders certainly did, for certain central purposes, a republican form is not simply preferable, as it might be for Hume, but necessary where possible. On the other hand, if we take Hume seriously, as the founders also did, we discover that within this republican form there are many salutary elements that cannot be accounted for or maintained on the basis of consent or even tacit consent. Culture and habituation are vital to stability. The English common law, accepted without fundamental modification by the founders, becomes, by the 1790s, one of the forums in which historically universal principles of right are slowly applied. Now, the blending of Lockean individualism and Humean, or what I'm calling Lockean individualism and Humean traditionalism or culture, is an intentional artifice of the American founding, I think. As a result, there is an important sense in which various friends of the founding need not be enemies of each other, excepting only at the highest levels of abstraction. The very last paragraph of The Federalist contains the only citation to Hume in the entire work. Hamilton quotes Hume. "To balance a large state or society, whether monarchical or republican, on general laws is a work of so great difficulty that no human genius, however comprehensive, is able, by the mere dint of reason and reflection, to effect it. The judgments of many must unite in the work. Experience must guide their labor. Time must bring it to perfection. And the feeling of inconveniences must correct the mistakes which they inevitably fall into in their first trials and experiments." And it's worth noting that Hamilton, in the very next breath, goes on to exalt as a prodigy the establishment of such a constitution with the consent of the whole people.